Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps podcast. We dive into stories of true crime, from unsolved cold cases to historic kidnapping to gangsters and beyond. We are your source for true crime. We thank you for listening.
Refresh your home today at Menards with window images, blinds, and shades. We have everything you need for updating your window treatments. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Save big on window treatments at Menards. Plus, get them cut to width in-store for free. Visit Menards.com and view our entire selection of window treatments today. Plus, the weekly flyer and other great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. This week's secret operation takes us back to the 60s, as Israel is on the hunt for justice. While the Nazi leader committed suicide in a bunker, the Israeli government is hunting for every single Nazi responsible for the murder of millions of Jews, and one of the biggest targets for them is Adolf Eichmann. And that is where we find ourselves today. Imagine it's the 60s, and one of the world's most wanted men, a key architect of the Holocaust, has been hiding in plain sight for years. The world has all but forgotten him, but not Israel. They've been quietly hunting, waiting for the moment to strike. This man, Adolf Eichmann, believed he had escaped justice, but in the shadows, a team of Israeli agents is planning one of the most daring, dangerous missions in history, Operation Finale. This isn't just a mission to capture a fugitive, it's a race against time, filled with secret identities, high-risk operations, constant threat of failure. How did they find Eichmann? How did they pull off the operation in a foreign land without tipping off anyone? And how did this covert mission forever change the course of history? Stay with me as we uncover the incredible true story behind Operation Finale, the mission that finally brought a Nazi war criminal to justice. Eichmann was one of the central figures responsible for the logistics behind the Holocaust, Nazi regime systematic extermination of 6 million Jews during World War II. As a high-ranking officer in the SS and head of the Reich Central Office for Jewish Emigration, Eichmann played a pivotal role in the implementation of the Final Solution, which sought to eradicate the Jewish population from Europe. Eichmann was appointed by Heinrich Himmler, the chief architect of the Holocaust, and was tasked with organizing the forced deportations of Jews to ghettos, concentration camps, and extermination camps like Auschwitz. Eichmann's bureaucratic expertise made him indispensable to the Nazi regime. He coordinated a vast network of trains that transported millions of Jews and other persecuted groups to their deaths. Eichmann wasn't just involved in the administrative side of the genocide, he visited concentration camps personally, ensuring that the deportation process was running efficiently. He orchestrated the mass deportations from Hungary, France, and the Netherlands, making critical decisions about which Jewish populations would be targeted and when. His work was described as meticulous and calculated, reflecting his ability to remove any human emotion from the process of organizing mass murder. What made Eichmann's role so chilling was his perceived detachment from the moral weight of his actions. He viewed himself as a mere bureaucrat executing orders. This claim would become the central point of his defense during his trial, where he famously stated he was simply following orders. Eichmann's capacity to carry out genocide at such a massive scale, while seemingly seeing it as a technical problem to be solved, was emblematic of the banality of evil that philosopher Hannah Arendt later explored in her writings about his trial. As the chief administrator of the Final Solution, Eichmann's primary responsibility was to ensure the efficient transportation of Jews from occupied territories to extermination camps. His work required him to collaborate with various Nazi ministries, including the Ministries of Transport, which controlled the railways, and the Ministry of the Interior, which handled the bureaucratic aspects of deportation. Eichmann's office was central in organizing the mass deportations, including securing trains, coordinating schedules, and working with regional authorities to round up Jewish populations. Eichmann oversaw the entire deportation process. This involved identifying Jewish communities across Nazi-occupied Europe, stripping them of their rights and property, and sending them to their deaths. His ability to manage the logistics of genocide with ruthless efficiency earned him the title of Chief Executioner of the Final Solution. One of the most infamous deportations Eichmann coordinated was the mass deportation of Hungarian Jews in 1944. Under his direct supervision, nearly 440,000 Hungarian Jews were sent to Auschwitz over a period of just 2 months, one of the largest and most concentrated deportations of the Holocaust. Eichmann's methods involved manipulating local officials, forcing them to cooperate with Nazi policies, and deceiving Jewish leaders about their fate. His ability to convince people to trust him despite the lethal outcomes he orchestrated made him particularly dangerous. The Allied forces closed in on Germany in 1945. Many high-ranking Nazi officials were captured, tried, and executed for their crimes. However, Adolf Eichmann managed to escape justice after the end of the war. Initially captured by American forces in 1945, he escaped from a POW camp using forged documents and went into hiding under a false identity. At the time, Eichmann's role in the Holocaust was not yet fully known, allowing him to evade immediate prosecution. For the next few years, Eichmann lived under various aliases, moving between locations in Germany under the name of Otto Hinninger. He avoided detection by posing as an ordinary former soldier. During this time, he worked as a laborer and kept a low profile, knowing that the Allies were hunting for high-ranking Nazi officials involved in war crimes. In 1950, Eichmann recognized that Europe was becoming increasingly dangerous for former Nazis, as war crimes investigations intensified. He sought assistance from the network known as the Ratlines, a system of escape routes for Nazi fugitives, and often relied on sympathizers within the Catholic Church and other institutions. Through this network, Eichmann was able to obtain false identification and travel to Italy. There, with the help of pro-Nazi clergy, he secured a Red Cross passport named Ricardo Clement and made his way to Argentina, a country known for harboring many former Nazi officials. Upon arriving in Argentina in 1950, Eichmann began his new life under the false identity of Ricardo Clement. He settled in Buenos Aires, where he lived modestly with his family. Unlike other high-profile Nazi fugitives who enjoyed lavish lifestyles in exile, Eichmann took great care to blend into the working-class fabric of Argentine society. He took up manual labor jobs, including working for a local Mercedes-Benz plant, and lived a quiet life in a suburb of Buenos Aires. For nearly a decade, Eichmann lived under the radar, believing he had escaped justice for his role in the Holocaust. However, he maintained contact with his family, who eventually joined him in Argentina. Despite the passage of time, Eichmann's involvement in the Nazi regime was not forgotten. Holocaust survivors and Nazi hunters remained determined to bring him to justice. Eichmann's wife and sons used the family name Eichmann in Argentina, which raised suspicions and brought renewed attention to his whereabouts. Ida Eichmann's downfall came when his son Klaus Eichmann began dating a young woman whose father was a Holocaust survivor. Klaus boasted to her about his father's role in the Nazi regime, which led to her father informing Nazi hunters in Europe. This crucial piece of intelligence was passed by Israeli intelligence agent Mossad, which launched a covert operation to confirm Eichmann's identity and location. By 1960, Mossad had gathered enough evidence to act. They orchestrated one of the most daring covert operations in modern history, Operation Finale, which resulted in Eichmann's capture and eventual trial in Israel. His life under the alias Ricardo Clement came to an abrupt end, and finally brought to justice for his role in one of the darkest chapters in human history. While we mentioned how Eichmann was eventually discovered and captured, we're going to dive a little deeper into how exactly he was tracked. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, many high-ranking Nazi officials were apprehended and put on trial during the Nuremberg trials. However, a significant number, including Adolf Eichmann, managed to evade capture by fleeing Germany or assuming new identities. For Holocaust survivors, the memories of the atrocities committed by these individuals remained fresh. Survivors like Simon Wiesenthal, who performed horrors of the Holocaust, were determined to ensure that Nazi war criminals, especially those like Eichmann, were brought to justice. Eichmann became one of the most prominent figures in the global effort to track down and expose fugitive Nazis. He dedicated his life to Nazi hunting, establishing a network of contacts across Europe, and gathering evidence that kept Eichmann's name in the public eye. Eichmann was not just another Nazi, he was the bureaucrat who had overseen the deportation of millions of Jews to concentration camps. Eichmann was often seen as the embodiment of the banality of evil, a man who facilitated genocide, not through ideology, through efficient paperwork and logistics. Wiesenthal never gave up the search for Eichmann. In the early post-war years, the world's attention shifted to the rebuilding of Europe, and the pursuit of justice for Nazi war crimes sometimes lost priority. However, Simon kept Eichmann's name alive by consistently publishing reports, lobbying governments, and working with like-minded organizations to ensure that people like Eichmann would not fade into obscurity. He believed that Eichmann represented an unresolved chapter of history, a reminder of the Holocaust's darkest days and the importance of accountability. By keeping Eichmann's crimes in the public discourse, Wiesenthal and other survivors helped maintain a sense of urgency around capturing Nazi war criminals. But Wiesenthal did not directly lead to Eichmann's capture. His unyielding commitment to hunting war criminals played a significant role in reminding governments and the public that justice had not yet been fully served. While Adolf Eichmann had gone to great lengths to conceal his identity and evade capture, the critical mistake that led to his discovery came not from him, but from his son Klaus. By the 1950s, Adolf Eichmann was living in Buenos Aires under the alias Ricardo Clement and assumed a quiet, low-life profile, life to avoid suspicion, unlike some other Nazi leaders who kind of lived a lavish lifestyle. However, Klaus was, unlike his father, did not adopt the same level of caution. Eichmann had been raised with pride in his father's involvement in the Nazi regime, and his admiration for the Nazi ideology continued into adulthood. In the late 50s, Klaus began dating a young German woman named Sylvia Hermann, unbeknownst to Klaus. Sylvia's father was a German-Jewish Holocaust survivor who had fled Germany to escape persecution. Klaus, seemingly oblivious to the sensitivity of his remarks, began openly bragging about his father's role in Nazi government to Sylvia and her family. He hinted that his father, living under the name Ricardo Clement, was the same Adolf Eichmann who had played a central role in the Holocaust. Lothar Hermann, though nearly blind, was a sharp-minded man who had not forgotten the atrocities committed by the Nazis. Klaus's casual boasting triggered Lothar's suspicions, and he quickly realized that his daughter's boyfriend might be connected to one of the most wanted war criminals in the world. Determined to investigate further, he contacted Nazi hunters in Germany, providing them with critical information that Klaus had inadvertently revealed. The tip was passed on to Fritz Bauer, a West German prosecutor who was already working quietly to track down Nazi war criminals. Fritz took the lead on the investigation, knowing that this could be the breakthrough needed to find Eichmann. He began coordinating with Israeli intelligence, sharing the tip that could lead to confirmation of Eichmann's whereabouts. Klaus's careless comments were the first concrete lead in years, and they set in motion a chain of events that would eventually lead to Eichmann's capture. Once the tip reached the West German authorities, it was immediately shared with Israeli intelligence, particularly with Mossad, Israel's national intelligence agency, who you do not want to come face to face with. Pursuit of Adolf Eichmann had always been a high priority for Israel, not just for justice, but for the historical and symbolic importance of bringing one of the chief architects of the Holocaust to trial. Mossad's director at the time recognized the gravity of this new information and took swift action. However, the task of confirming whether Ricardo Clement was truly Adolf Eichmann required absolute discretion. Argentina had long been known as a safe haven for Nazi war criminals, and the Argentine government had historically shown little interest in extraditing former Nazis. If Mossad's efforts were discovered, it could compromise not only the mission, but also Israeli-Argentine relations. Thus, the operation had to be carried out under the radar. Mossad agents were dispatched to Buenos Aires, where they began covert surveillance of Ricardo Clement. They observed his daily routine, noting his movements and interactions, all while keeping a safe distance to avoid detection. The agents also began compiling information on Clement's background, comparing it with known details about Eichmann, such as his height, physical characteristics, and mannerisms. One of the key figures in this operation was Zvi Aroni, a Mossad agent with experience in Nazi hunting. Aroni meticulously analyzed Clement's behavior and began collecting evidence that would either confirm or refute his true identity. Simultaneously, Mossad worked closely with Fritz in Germany, who was assisting in gathering intelligence and keeping the operation confidential. Fritz, a key player in prosecuting Nazi criminals, understood the political and diplomatic delicacies that ensured that the information exchanged remained tightly controlled. Assad and Fritz worked hand-in-hand, piecing together every bit of intelligence they could find to ensure that Clement was indeed Eichmann before any further action was taken. After several months of surveillance, Assad agents became increasingly convinced that Ricardo Clement was in fact Adolf Eichmann. They observed Clement's habits and his family dynamics and noted several physical details that matched descriptions of Eichmann. The final confirmation came when Mossad agents compared old photographs of Eichmann to those of Clement. Despite the passage of time and Eichmann's attempts to change his appearance, key features remained the same. Once Mossad had gathered sufficient evidence, they received authorization from the Israeli government to move forward with the next phase of the operation, capturing Eichmann and smuggling him out of Argentina. This would culminate in one of the most daring and successful covert missions in history, Operation Finale, bringing one of the last remaining masterminds of the Holocaust to justice. The decision to launch Operation Finale was not made lightly, as it represented one of the most significant and controversial operations in Israel's early history. Adolf Eichmann was in hiding for over a decade, and although the atrocities of the Holocaust were still fresh in the collective memory of the Jewish people, the world was beginning to move on from World War II. For Israel, however, bringing Eichmann to justice was not just a matter of legal responsibility, but a moral and national duty. His capture would provide an opportunity for the victims of the Holocaust to face one of the primary architects of their suffering. As Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, confirmed Eichmann's location in Argentina, Prime Minister David faced a critical decision. Should Israel risk an international incident by abducting Eichmann on foreign soil, or should they trust in diplomatic or legal measures that could take years or fail entirely? Argentina had a reputation for harboring Nazi war criminals and was unlikely to cooperate in extraditing Eichmann. Moreover, Eichmann could escape again if tipped off, rendering all the hard work and intelligence gathering by Mossad useless. For the Prime Minister, the urgency of capturing Eichmann outweighed the risks. Mossad Director Sarah Harel was committed to bringing Eichmann to trial. He had spent years pursuing Nazis who had fled to South America, and Eichmann presented the ultimate target, the man responsible for the logistics of the Holocaust. They viewed Eichmann's capture as both a moral victory and a message to the world that Israel would stop at nothing to bring justice to those who had committed heinous crimes against the Jewish people. The decision was made after weighing the possible fallout from violating Argentina's sovereignty. Ben-Gurion understood that if the operation were discovered before Eichmann could be safely brought to Israel, it could lead to a diplomatic crisis. However, they justified the mission based on the unique nature of Eichmann's crimes, which transcended national borders. Eichmann had been responsible for the systematic extermination of millions of people, and normal diplomatic channels could not be trusted to deliver justice. Ben-Gurion's personal conviction that Eichmann needed to be tried publicly in Israel played a critical role in moving forward with the operation. The trial would allow the world to hear firsthand testimonies from Holocaust survivors, keeping the memory of the genocide alive and making Eichmann face his accusers in a court of law. It would be a moment of reckoning, not just for Eichmann, but for the Nazi regime and its legacy. Capturing Eichmann alive was one of the central tenets of Operation Finale. The Israeli government and Mossad understood that killing Eichmann during the mission would have been easier, but it would have deprived the world of a public trial where Eichmann would be held accountable for his crimes in front of an international audience. The trial would serve as a historical record of the atrocities committed during the Holocaust, educate future generations about the dangers of unchecked hatred and tyranny. There was also legal and ethical considerations. Israel had to decide whether abducting Eichmann from a sovereign country without the country's permission was justifiable. Under normal circumstances, kidnapping a foreign national would be a violation of international law. However, Eichmann's case was far from ordinary. Eichmann had orchestrated crimes against humanity, and many in the Israeli government believe that justice transcended the boundaries of international law in this case. Israel faced a moral dilemma. Could they justify violating Argentina's sovereignty to ensure that Eichmann faced trial for his crimes? Would the world see this as a necessary act of justice, or would Israel face condemnation for taking matters into its own hands? Ultimately, Israel's leadership concluded that Eichmann's capture was a moral imperative. His trial would provide a measure of closure to Holocaust survivors and reinforce the principle that war criminals could never escape justice, no matter how long they had been in hiding or where they had fled. Planning this operation required assembling a team of highly skilled Mossad agents, each with the specialized expertise necessary for such a delicate and dangerous mission. Mossad Director Sir Harel was deeply involved in selecting the team, knowing that the success of the mission depended on the professionalism and dedication of the agents involved. The agents had to operate covertly in a foreign country, track Eichmann without alerting him or the Argentine authorities, and execute the abduction without causing an international incident. Now, before I dive into these names, I apologize if I say these names wrong. One of the key figures in the operation was Zvi Aharoni, a Mossad agent with a background in Nazi hunting. His task was to confirm Eichmann's identity through discreet surveillance and investigation. And this was no easy feat, as Eichmann had been living under the alias Ricardo Clement and had physically changed over the years. Aharoni's attention to detail, combined with his experience tracking Nazis in post-war Europe, made him the perfect agent to lead this part of the mission. Rafi Eitan was chosen to be the field commander of the operation. He had extensive experience in covert operations and was known for his leadership in high-stress situations. As the man responsible for overseeing the entire operation on the ground, Eitan had to ensure that each aspect of the mission ran smoothly and that all contingencies were accounted for. His job was to coordinate between the various agents, manage any unexpected developments, and ensure that Eichmann was captured and transported safely to Israel. Another critical member of the team was Peter Malkin, who would play the lead role in physically apprehending Eichmann. He was known for his calm demeanor and under pressure and his experience with undercover operations. During the abduction, he would be the agent who physically grabbed Eichmann off the street and subdued him before the team whisked him away to a safe house. Malkin's ability to remain calm in intense situations was critical to ensuring that the capture went off without a hitch. Each member of the team was selected not only for their skills, but also for their emotional resilience. The agents, would be confronting one of the most notorious war criminals in history, a man who had directly contributed to the murder of millions of Jews. Many of the agents had personal connections to the Holocaust, making the emotional weight of the mission even greater. Logistics of Operation Finale were daunting. The team would need to execute every part of the mission with precision, from the initial surveillance of Eichmann to the abduction, holding him in secret, finally smuggling him out of the country. Each step was fraught with potential pitfalls, and even the smallest mistake could expose the operation and lead to its failure. The first challenge was confirming Eichmann's identity without alerting him to the fact that he was being watched. The SOD agents had to surveil Eichmann's house, follow his movements, and gather intelligence on his daily routine. Eichmann lived in a modest home in Buenos Aires suburb and followed a predictable schedule. The Mossad team had to remain inconspicuous, blending into the local environment, ensuring they did not raise suspicion. A key part of the surveillance involved observing Eichmann as he walked home from work. This would later inform their decision to capture him during one of these walks. Once Eichmann's identity was confirmed, the team had to plan the abduction with military precision. The agents decided that the best opportunity to capture him would be during his walk from the bus stop to his home. The location was relatively isolated, allowing them to minimize the risk of witnesses. The abduction itself had to be quick, silent, and seamless. Any sign of struggle or hesitation could draw unwanted attention. The agents rehearsed the abduction multiple times, running through every possible scenario. They planned for contingencies, such as what to do if Eichmann resisted or if a bystander interfered. Every detail from the timing to the vehicles used was carefully calculated to ensure that the mission went off without a hitch. Perhaps the most challenging aspect of the operation was smuggling Eichmann out of Argentina. Assad had arranged for a plane to arrive in Buenos Aires under the pretense of a diplomatic visit. Timing had to be perfect. Eichmann needed to be captured, held in a safe house, then transported to the airport without attracting attention. Any delay or deviation from the plan could result in the mission being compromised. Assad agents faced the additional challenge of keeping Eichmann alive and healthy during the days before his capture and his departure. He was kept in a safe house, guarded around the clock, while Assad finalized the details of his extraction. During this time, the agents also worked to ensure that Eichmann would not be discovered by Argentine authorities or Nazi sympathizers. Argentina had a large German expatriate community, including many Nazi sympathizers, and the team knew that if Eichmann's capture was discovered, it could lead to public outcry or even violent retaliation. Additionally, Argentina's government had a history of protecting former Nazis, so the team had to be prepared for the possibility that local authorities could try to intervene. Every precaution was taken to avoid leaving any trace of the operation, and the team operated under strict secrecy until Eichmann was safely aboard the plane bound for Israel. The logistics of Operation Finale were complex, but the agency's meticulous planning, attention to detail, and unwavering commitment to justice allowed them to overcome each challenge. The operation would ultimately be remembered as one of the most daring and successful covert missions in modern history. So, about that capture. On May 11, 1960, after months of preparation and careful surveillance, the Mossad team was ready to execute one of the most daring covert operations in history. The mission was to abduct Adolf Eichmann, one of the chief architects of the Holocaust, from his hiding place in Argentina and smuggle him back to Israel to stand trial for his crimes. The team had pinpointed Eichmann's daily routine, noting that he regularly took the same bus home from his job at a Mercedes-Benz plant, disembarking in a quiet suburban neighborhood of Buenos Aires. The decision to proceed with the abduction on May 11th was based on the meticulous surveillance work done by Mossad agent Zavi. who had confirmed that Ricardo Clement was indeed Adolf Eichmann. Mossad team knew they had to strike quickly and with precision. Any mistake could lead to Eichmann escaping, alerting the authorities, or triggering an international incident. Chosen location for the abduction was a stretch of road along Eichmann's walking route from the bus stop to his house. The area was relatively isolated, reducing the risk of witnesses, but still close enough to Eichmann's home that it wouldn't raise his suspicions. Time approached, the team waited in a pair of parked cars. Their nerves stretched thin. They knew that everything hinged on perfect timing and execution. The operation had to be swift and silent, leaving no traces behind. Around 8:05 p.m., Eichmann stepped off the bus, walking the familiar route back to his house, unaware that this would be his last night as a free man. Mossad agents were positioned along the roadside, waiting for the exact moment to strike. Eichmann was walking alone, and the streets were quiet. The agents, Peter, Rafi, and several others, prepared to make their move. As Eichmann walked past one of the parked cars, Peter quickly exited the vehicle and approached him. In a matter of seconds, he grabbed Eichmann from behind, using a well-practiced technique to subdue him without giving him time to scream or struggle. Peter's arm locked around Eichmann's neck, while other agents rushed in to help immobilize him. Eichmann was forced to the ground and thrown into the back of one of the waiting cars. The entire abduction took place in less than a minute. No time for a struggle, and no one on the quiet street witnessed the event. Eichmann was dazed and confused by the suddenness of the attack. The SOG team drove away quickly, heading towards a safe house where they would hold Eichmann while they finally explained for his extraction to Israel. In the car, Eichmann remained silent, likely in shock from the suddenness of the abduction. Once Eichmann was safely inside the Mossad safe house, the team immediately began interrogating him to confirm his true identity. Eichmann, still trying to process what had happened, initially denied being Adolf Eichmann. He insisted that his name was Ricardo Clement, the alias he had used for over a decade in Argentina. However, the Mossad agents had done their homework, and they knew that Eichmann's denial was merely a tactic to buy time. During the interrogation, Eichmann's behavior was carefully observed. His attempts to maintain the Ricardo Clement persona began to falter, as Mossad agents pressed him with specific questions about his past. The team had physical descriptions of Eichmann from the time of the war, including scars and distinguishing marks. They methodically checked these to ensure they had the right man. Eichmann grew increasingly nervous, but still tried to deny his true identity. At one point, as Mossad agents continued to pressure him, Eichmann realized that there was no escaping the truth. He eventually admitted his truth, muttering the words, "I am Adolf Eichmann." Confirmation was the moment the agents had been waiting for. He had captured one of the most wanted men in the world, and he was now in their custody. Following Eichmann's confession, the Mossad team moved quickly to secure him and prepare for his extraction. Eichmann was held in the safe house for several days, during which the team faced a new set of challenges. First and foremost, they had to ensure that no one in Argentina, especially the authorities or Nazi sympathizers, found out about the abduction. Argentina had a significant German expatriate community, and any hint that Eichmann had been captured could spark an outcry or even violence. Eichmann was kept under constant watch, on agents guarding him around the clock. He was treated humanely though the agents took no chances with his security. They knew that if Eichmann attempted to escape or if word got out that he had been captured, the entire operation could collapse. The agents also worked to keep Eichmann in good physical health, knowing that they needed to present him alive and well when he returned to Israel. Another challenge was Eichmann's demeanor during his captivity. While he initially seemed dazed and confused, Eichmann soon began to adopt a calm, almost resigned attitude. He engaged in conversation with the agents guarding him and even discussed mundane topics as though they're trying to normalize his situation. Mossad agents who had personal connections to the Holocaust. This interaction was emotionally taxing. They were faced with the reality that the man they were holding captive was responsible for the deaths of millions of their people. Yet they had to treat him professionally and with dignity until they could bring him to trial. The days in the safe house were tense. The Mossad team knew that time was running out and that they had to move Eichmann out of Argentina quickly before anyone noticed his disappearance. The final phase of the mission extraction was fast approaching, and they had to ensure that every detail was executed perfectly to avoid detection. Now we've come to the point where Mossad have to extract him from Argentina. And of course, there were some diplomatic and legal challenges. The extraction of Adolf Eichmann from Argentina was the most delicate and dangerous part of Operation Finale. While capturing Eichmann was a remarkable feat, the mission was far from over. The Mossad team had to figure out how to smuggle Eichmann out of the country without raising the alarm. Argentina was known for harboring Nazi war criminals, and the government had turned a blind eye to their presence. Argentine authorities discovered the abduction and could lead to a full-blown diplomatic crisis, especially if Eichmann's powerful Nazi sympathizers caught wind of the operation. The Mossad team knew that the time was of the essence. They had to move quickly before Eichmann's disappearance was noticed by his family or anyone in the local community. Mossad agents also had to operate under the radar, ensuring that neither local law enforcement nor immigration officials became suspicious of their activities. They were aware that Argentina's government could not be trusted to cooperate, as the country had a history of protecting former Nazis living within its borders. To avoid detection, Mossad agents operated with extreme caution, using fake identities and elaborate cover stories. They had entered Argentina using false passports and posed as tourists or businessmen. The team also took precautions to avoid being followed or observed by anyone who might have connections to Eichmann's former Nazi colleagues in Argentina. Communication between the agents were kept to a minimum, and they maintained a strict low profile. Once Eichmann had been safely secured in the safe house, Saad began preparing for his extraction. This was the riskiest part of the mission because it involved getting Eichmann out of the country without triggering suspicion at the airport or with immigration officials. If Eichmann were to be discovered by the Argentine authorities, the entire operation would be compromised, and Israel would face serious diplomatic consequences for carrying out an illegal abduction on foreign soil. The Mossad team devised an audacious plan to smuggle Eichmann out of Argentina by air using an Israeli plane that was scheduled to leave Buenos Aires under the cover of a diplomatic mission. The agents knew that the key to success was disguising Eichmann in a way that would allow him to pass through airport security without arousing suspicion. After careful consideration, the Mossad team decided to drug Eichmann and disguise him as a flight attendant who was too intoxicated to board the flight on his own. The team used a sedative to ensure Eichmann would be calm and manageable throughout the flight. Once sedated, Eichmann was dressed in a flight attendant's uniform and placed in a wheelchair. Mossad agents would escort him through customs, pretending that he was a crew member who had too much to drink before the flight. The ruse worked perfectly. Mossad agents accompanied Eichmann to the airport, maintaining the appearance that they were simply assisting an inebriated colleague. At the airport, they navigated the usual security and customs checks without incident. Argentine officials, who were used to seeing international diplomats and Israeli crew members pass through the airport, saw nothing out of the ordinary. The agents used their diplomatic cover and the prearranged flight to get Eichmann through the airport and onto the plane without raising any alarms. Once on board, Eichmann remained heavily sedated and under guard. The flight from Buenos Aires to Israel was one of the most tense moments in the entire operation. If anything had gone wrong during the airport clearance or on the flight itself, our mission could have been exposed. And now, of course, Eichmann is standing trial. Adolf Eichmann's trial began in April 1961 and was a landmark moment in both legal history and the global reckoning with the Holocaust. It marked the first time that a high-ranking Nazi official directly involved in the orchestration of the Final Solution was prosecuted in a public international court. Prior to Eichmann's capture, many Nazi war criminals had been tried at the Nuremberg trials. Eichmann's trial stood out because of its deeply personal nature for the Jewish people and its importance to Israel. This was the first time that the newly established State of Israel had brought a Nazi criminal to justice on its own soil. The trial took place in Jerusalem with judges presiding under Israeli law. However, it was more than a national affair. It was a global event that captivated audiences worldwide. For many, the trial symbolized the triumph of justice over one of the most heinous regimes in history. It was a moment of profound significance, especially for Holocaust survivors, as it gave them the opportunity to see one of the key figures responsible for the suffering and the deaths of millions and trial for his crimes. Proceedings also brought unprecedented international attention to Israel, which presented itself not as a refuge for survivors, but as a nation dedicated to the pursuit of justice, even decades after the war had ended. Eichmann's capture and trial proved that war criminals could be held no matter how far they ran or how long they had evaded justice. One of the most powerful aspects of Eichmann's trial was that it brought the voices of Holocaust survivors to the forefront, allowing the world to hear firsthand accounts of the atrocities committed during the Holocaust. The trial was televised globally, making it one of the first major international trials to be broadcast. For many people, especially those who had not fully grasped the scale of the Holocaust, this was the first time they saw and heard survivors recount their experiences in vivid, heartbreaking detail. Survivors took the stand took the stand to describe the horror in the concentration camps, the loss of their families, and the brutality they witnessed. The testimonies were raw and emotional, often leaving the courtroom and the global audience in stunned silence. These personal accounts painted a vivid picture of the suffering inflicted by the Nazi regime, Eichmann's logistical planning playing a central role in the deaths of millions. The trial not only reminded the world of the horrors of the Holocaust, but also brought new attention to the survivors, many of whom had lived in silence about their experiences for years. The emotional impact of the trial was profound, reigniting global discussions about the need for remembrance and education about the Holocaust to prevent future atrocities. The televised trial had helped cement the Holocaust in public consciousness, ensuring that the crimes Eichmann helped commit could not be forgotten. It also helped to humanize the victims, giving names, faces, and stories to the millions who perished, transforming them from numbers in a history book into real people whose lives were torn apart by Eichmann's action. The trial lasted 8 months, and Eichmann was found guilty on multiple counts, including crimes against humanity, war crimes, and crimes against the Jewish people. On December 15, 1961, Adolf Eichmann was sentenced to death, the only civilian ever to receive the death penalty in Israel. His execution by hanging took place on June 1, 1962. Eichmann's trial and sentencing was seen as a momentous victory for justice. It was not just about punishing one man. It was about holding accountable those who participated in the greatest crime of the 20th century. For Holocaust survivors, Eichmann's conviction provided a sense of closure, a recognition that suffering they endured would not go unanswered. For the global community, it underscored the principle that war criminals, no matter how powerful or how far they fled, did not escape justice. The trial had a lasting impact on the field of international law, setting a precedent for how future war crimes and crimes against humanity would be prosecuted. It reinforced the idea that even individuals in bureaucratic roles who may not have physically committed atrocities could still be held accountable if they were complicit in facilitating genocide. The legacy of Eichmann's trial extended beyond the courtroom. It became a pivotal moment in the global memory of the Holocaust, ensuring that future generations would not forget the horrors of the Nazi regime. The trial was a triumph for human rights, serving as a stark reminder that justice could be achieved even decades after the first or after the fact, and that the world must remain vigilant in holding accountable those who commit atrocities. Eichmann's execution marked the final chapter in his role as one of the masterminds of the Holocaust, but the trial itself left an indelible mark on the world's understanding of justice, accountability, and the importance of never forgetting the past. Operation Finale is often regarded as one of the most remarkable and successful covert operations of the 20th century, and it had a profound impact on the future of intelligence work, particularly within Mossad. The mission to capture Adolf Eichmann set new standards for clandestine operations, proving that meticulous planning, careful surveillance, and creative problem-solving could yield extraordinary results, even in hostile or challenging environments. For Mossad, the operation demonstrated the agency's ability to operate far beyond Israel's borders and carry out complex missions with minimal resources in foreign territories. It showcased Mossad's skill in gathering intelligence, tracking high-profile targets, and executing high-stakes abductions without alerting authorities or endangering the broader mission. Eichmann's capture was a masterclass in patience, precision, and risk management, all hallmarks of effective intelligence work. In the years following the mission, Mossad would go on to conduct numerous covert operations, many of which bore the hallmarks of the planning and execution strategies employed during Operation Finale. The agency became known for its precision strikes, undercover missions, and relentless pursuit of justice, particularly in its efforts to bring war criminals and terrorists to justice. Mossad's later operations to track down and neutralize members of Black September after the Munich Olympics massacre, as well as its counterterrorism efforts, can trace their tactical and strategic lineage back to the methodologies pioneered during Operation Finale. The success of the Eichmann mission also highlighted the critical importance of international cooperation in intelligence work. Although the operation was carried out primarily by Israeli agents, it relied on intelligence and support from international partners, including West German officials and Jewish organizations around the world. This precedent underscored the value of collaboration between nations in pursuing transnational justice, reinforced the idea that intelligence work in the post-war era would increasingly require cooperation across borders. Eichmann's trial in 1961 became a pivotal moment not only in the pursuit of justice, but also in the way the world remembers the Holocaust. The trial was one of the first to put the Holocaust front and center on the global stage, allowing survivors to testify publicly and recount their experiences of the Nazi regime's crimes. Broadcast globally, the trial became a defining moment of historical and moral reckoning, bringing the atrocities of the Holocaust into homes around the world and forcing nations to confront the full scope of the genocide. The trial also reinforced the importance of seeking justice no matter how much time had passed. Eichmann had been living freely in Argentina for years, yet his capture and trial proved that time does not erase the need for accountability. The message of the trial was clear. Those who commit crimes against humanity will eventually face justice, even if it takes decades to bring them to trial. Holocaust remembrance has become a global priority, with museums, memorials, and educational programs dedicated to ensuring that the lessons of the Holocaust are never forgotten. The trial's emphasis on justice and remembrance continues to resonate in today's world, particularly in how modern justice systems pursue war criminals for more recent conflicts. The legacy of Operation Finale and Eichmann's trial reminds us that the pursuit of justice is a moral obligation that transcends borders and time frames, and it reinforces the global commitment to remembering and learning from the darkest chapters of human history. Before we move on, let me know your thoughts on Operation Finale in the comments section below, and of course, give us a thumbs up if you like our video. Hit that subscribe button down below. Yes, that shiny subscribe button. And just go right next to it and hit that bell notification button to be notified of future videos. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. Your support helps the channel grow, upgrade our equipment, bring in new hosts, and hopefully take this show on the road. And your support can help make that happen. Whether it's $1, $5, $20, $50, or $100, anything helps this channel grow. And as always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you next time.
You have been listening to the True Crime Never Sleeps podcast. Thank you for listening. You can follow us on Facebook at True Crime Never Sleeps podcast and on Twitter at True Crime NS. And follow us on Instagram at True Crime Never Sleeps. Thanks for watching. If you want to support the show, buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS or become a patron at patreon.com/TrueCrimeNeverSleeps.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, oh.